mother. You're the nephew of James Joyce. And I would like to know, what did your mother tell you about her, about Joyce and about what he wrote?
Well, I grew up at a time when Joyce was a dirty word in Ireland. My mother used to tell us that while we should never deny the fact that we were related to James Joyce, we didn't have to advertise it either. So she spoke very little about him. She was extremely proud of him, and she had, what do you call them, she cut out newspaper clippings, scrapbooks. She had scrapbooks full of newspaper cuttings about him.
About him.
But she never actually spoke to us very much.
Mm-hmm.
They had had the overpowering part of her early life had been when the family moved from the comforts and security of the fashionable south side of Dublin to the great poverty and destitution of the north inner city. And in a period of 11 years, from 1893 to 1904, the family lived in approximately 16 different houses, moving whenever the rent fell due, moving in the middle. And it was a time of great pain, and so the memory of it was very painful, so they never spoke about it.
She didn't speak about the family, or what did she tell you? She told you something.
Well, she would talk about her father, all right, that old blackguard she used to call him. She spoke about Jim Coo, about you know, how kind he was when he was younger to the girls in the family. But I always got the impression, though she never actually said it, that she didn't approve of the fact that he had run away with Nora Barlico. You know, they ran away and they lived together in sin for many years. And she wasn't a very religious woman, my mother, but she, I don't think she, that part of it she didn't like.
Because he only married Nora many years after.
Many years, 27 years later, in 1931. And then he just married to legalize the position
of
the children.
Mm-hmm.
However, my mother would talk about, as I say, mainly about her father, but she would talk about Jim too. But gradually, as time went on, and he didn't keep in touch with any of his sisters back in Ireland. Gradually, you know,
there's,
it was just the
somebody
way.
He wrote to very frequently asking things.
That was much earlier. That was when he left Ireland first. When he was writing, Ulysses, for instance, he would write to his Aunt Josephine. And he would send home a notebook with all sorts of questions. And she would have to go around and try and find the answers. You know, how many trees are outside the Church of the Star at the Sea in Sandymount? Could a man 5'9.5" tall and weighing 11 stone 4 pounds lower himself into the area outside number 7 Echo Street without not injuring himself? You know, all sorts of questions. Where is so-and-so now? Does Joyce... he'd ask, where is Mr. O'Brien and his daughters now? Where are they living? This sort of stuff. But he never did that with any of his sisters. He never had any great contact with them at all over the years.
He was very fond of his father, wasn't he?
He was, yes. He had a peculiar relationship, not peculiar, but he had a difficult relationship with both his father and his mother.
Mm-hmm.
When he was a small boy, he was very attached to his mother. But gradually, as time went on, he grew apart from her and began to admire his father. His father was, according to Richard Ellman, who has written the definitive biography of Joyce, his father was one of the most gifted reprobates in Ireland. You know what a reprobate
yeah.
is? And that really just summed him up. My mother sometimes would, she would talk more about the father now than she ever spoke about Jim. You know, she would talk about the terror that they would feel when they hear his key in the door in the evening.
Because
Because he was drunk and he would beat them. They moved frequently when they were over here on the north side. They often moved in the middle of the night to avoid the landlords.
To avoid the landlord.
You know, to avoid paying the rent. And, you know, she would talk about being wakened up at 2 o'clock in the morning
mm-hmm.
and being told, get dressed, we're moving again.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the things that also shaped Joyce.
Certainly.
But this was the time in his life when he accumulated the material and the characters and the stories that he was afterwards to use in his
mm-hmm.
writings.
Such as whom, for example? Can you
well, establish? Practically all of them. You know, his father, particularly
mm-hmm.
his father. His father appears and reappears in various guises and disguises throughout all of Joyce's writing, from the very first story. Practically every story in the book, you'll find the father, the shades of the father there. The very first story, the sisters. At that time, Joyce referred to his father and mother as his uncle and aunt.
Mm-hmm.
But they figure prominently in the very first story, and from then on, there's barely a story of which he doesn't appear in some way or another. In Ulysses, he
mm-hmm.
makes all sorts of appearances, maybe only the sound of his voice or the description of his attitude. But he'll appear in one
in
character.
Bloom or
sometimes in Bloom, yes, even in Bloom. He appears himself as under the name of Simon Dedalus in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But he also appears in Bloom. Some of his sayings or his wit will come out in one of the other characters
mm-hmm.
in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that Joyce used his own family to an enormous degree. Like my mother makes two fleeting appearances in Ulysses
mm-hmm.
Under the name of Katie Dedalus.
Katie Dedalus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're very short cameo performances indeed. But, you know, all of the sisters appear in one way or another. And that was the way it was with Joyce. He used the city of Dublin, he used his own family, he used his father's friends, his own friends as characters. Their stories are interwoven with all.
He used everything to write.
He did. He used everything, including the kitchen.
Yes. Well, what can we say about the relationship? What relationship is there between the relationship of Joyce and his mother and Stephen Dedalus and his mother?
Yes, a very, very, very strong resemblance. You know, In Ulysses, Stephen Dedalus's mother is dead.
Mm-hmm. And
in the first chapter,
mm-hmm.
he's visited by his mother's ghost in her loose brown grave cloths.
Mm-hmm.
And she appears again as a ghost to him in the Circe chapter of Ulysses. In real life, as I said, when Joyce was a small boy, he was very attached to his mother. His mother was very religious, mm-hmm. very musical. But gradually, as time went on, he grew away from, when he began to read more widely, when he began to read European literature, he grew away from his mother.
Christianism.
Yeah, when he read Dante, and he read Kaufmann, the German, and Ibsen, the Norwegian, and Hardy. Thomas Hardy, the Englishman.
But it's mainly because of religion, isn't it?
Well, to a degree it was, yes. To a degree. Or to a large degree it was. But there were other factors as well. You know, Ireland at that time was a very close, oppressive. Joyce always said that Dublin was gripped by a paralysis of the mind. You know, that Ireland as such was dominated by a right-wing autocratic...
About?
A right-wing autocratic Catholic church.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he felt he had to escape from the net, as he called it, of the family, of the church, and of the country, to get outside, to create
himself.
Yes, mm-hmm. in the smithy of his mind, the uncreative conscience of his race.
Mm-hmm.
One of the last words in Portrait of the Artist. But to get back to his mother, because I think his mother has a very... doesn't get as much attention from writers about Joyce as his father does. Now, his father was vitally important, but the relationship between Joyce and his mother was a very fragile thing. Just as an example, when Joyce was 20 years of age, when he just left university, he went off to Paris, ostensibly to study medicine, which he never did. And he was trying to live on what monies he could earn from giving English lessons or writing articles for the papers. Now his mother was back in Dublin with the other 9 children, no money and a drunken husband.
Yeah.
But James would still write home and look for help. You know, and some of his letters have survived in Elman's collected letters. You know, and he would write something like, "Dear Mother, please send me something. I haven't eaten for 5 days. My landlord is about to evict me. I'm freezing to death, I have no money to heat my room." And his poor mother would sell us something, piece of furniture from the house, or maybe pawn what was left of her jewelry, and send him a couple of pounds. And he would go to the theatre that night and have dinner. And then he would write home and tell... He would write home and tell his mother what...
It's incredible.
Incredible. And there's one letter of hers that has also survived, and it gives you... It gives you an insight, I think, into the relationship between the two of them. It also gives an inkling of how he was beginning to treat her, because it's a very short letter that just says, "My dear Jim, I am sorry if again you are disappointed in my letter, and if again I fail to understand what you would want me to know. Please believe me. It's not through want of a longing desire to do so and to please you, but as you have so often said, I am stupid and cannot understand the great thoughts that are yours. Do not wear out your soul with tears, but be as usual cheerful and look hopefully to the future." This is a lovely, I think, lovely little letter.
Yeah.
And she died the following
in
year.
In a way, she died...
He died the following year at the age of 43.
In a way, he was as sadic towards his mother as his father was.
He was...
He was sadistic towards his mother.
To a degree, like
his father was.
To a degree, yeah. Sadistic might be too strong a word, but I know what you mean.
Méchant.
Yes.
Like Stephen Dedalus.
Yes. He treated her with dismissal, sort of, as being... not important to. He was inclined to treat all women to a degree in that way.
By identification with Jim, or with his father, or with John.
Yeah, yes.
Something
probably
you can think,
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
So, the relationship with his father was very important,
yes,
for him. Can you say something about that more?
Yes,
in
he was. He was. He admired his father for, maybe, I suppose, if you like, for his father's faults,
mm-hmm,
as much as anything else. His father was a very talented man, a very gifted,
yes,
man in many ways. He was clever. He had a wonderful singing voice. He had a tenor,
mm-hmm,
voice. He had gone to university for a while, but had never worked. And he had a great fond of stories and was a great storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And Joyce admired all. And he also had a great contempt for authority,
yeah,
for people in authority particularly. And he would, you know, question their authority. And Joyce admired his independence of spirit. The father, on the other hand, was very, very proud of Samuel's son. You know, this,
yeah,
brilliant young man who was, he thought, going to get a good position in the city and, you know, restore
and
the family fortunes.
He did.
He did, not quite the same way as the father.
Yeah.
And the relationship between...
It's always like,
yeah,
that, anyway.
Yeah. But the, you know, the father, when James ran away with Nora Barnacle in 1904, the father knew that Jim was leaving the country, but he didn't know that Nora was going with,
mm-hmm,
him, and he was very angry when he found out. And there was this, for the first time, there was a kind of a break in their relationship. The father was very angry. And afterwards they made up. James came back in 1909, and afterwards they had they would write to one another every so often, but there was, after 1912, they were never to meet again. The father had a very lonely life here in Dublin. He lived,
yeah,
in all sorts of disreputable addresses. He lived for a time in a hostel for homeless men. By this time, James was living in Paris,
mm-hmm,
you know, living it up. And the father would write to him looking for help. "Dear Jim, please send me a pound," this sort of thing. Sometimes Jim would send him a pound, and sometimes he wouldn't. But
like
he would,
Jim did with
exactly,
his mother.
Exactly the same. And he would write home and promise that he would come home and visit Dublin and see his father, or that he would take the father out to Paris to live with him there. And of course, he never did. And eventually the father died in 1931. 29th December 31, at the age of 82. And when Jim got word of the death, he was absolutely shattered. He was full of guilt and remorse, because although Jim abandoned the practice of the Catholic faith when he was about 16, he never lost his Irish Catholic sense of guilt or belief in mortal sin.
I had thought about that,
yeah,
when I read Molly.
Yes.
Because Molly is not really free.
No. She's not.
Sex and love,
yeah,
are completely,
yeah,
separated from,
yeah,
Molly.
Yeah.
And I was very... the fact that... and men are bad for her. You know, the,
yeah,
relationship,
yeah,
between men and,
yes,
women,
yeah,
through Molly,
yeah,
is very bad, I think.
Oh, very bad.
That's why I think, in a way, even if people say Nora Barnacle inspired her, I think Joyce's mother, the relationship between his mother and his father is there as well.
It is. Mm-hmm. All of this is there. I mean, Joyce didn't waste any of these family relationships. But just to get back to the father,
mm-hmm,
because there's a very poignant Joyce hadn't seen his father for 19 years. And then the father died. And for a time, for about 2 months, James would do nothing but talk about his father, write letters to his friends about his father, and drink. He drank heavily at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then in February of 1932, just a month or 6 weeks afterwards, Joyce's only grandson, Stephen, was born.
Mm.
And Joyce wrote a little poem which expresses his joy at the birth of his grandson, his only grandson as it turned out to be, and his grief at the death of his father. And it's quite un-Joyce-like in that it's emotional.
You want to say it?
And it's called Ecce Pur, Behold the Boy, Behold the Boy.
Mm-hmm.
Of the dark past, the child is born. With joy and grief, my heart is torn. Calm in his cradle, the living lies. May love and mercy unclose his eyes. Young life is breathed on the glass. A world that was not comes to pass. A child is sleeping, an old man gone. O Father, forsake him, forgive your son.
How touching. Oh. And you say in such a marvelous way. You know, I was thinking about you and I said, in a way, you have disobeyed your mother, like Joyce, because you are now the director of the James Joyce Center. How come? How did this happen to you?
Well, I was always interested in Joyce, and I, from the very beginning, from the time I was about, I read Dubliners when I was about 18, and I read Portrait of the Artist when I was about in my early 20s. I didn't read Ulysses for many, many years. You couldn't get a copy of it here anywhere, you know. And I had, when I did get a copy, finally, I had about at least 12 failed attempts of reading it, you know.
Because you wanted to understand everything.
I suppose that's what I tell people now. Don't try to understand everything. Just keep going, and it'll come to you in time. I've read it maybe a dozen times now, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I've read different chapters.
Yeah, you have to.
Many, many times.
You have to play.
And every time you go back, you get something new. So, I.
So it's through his work that you got in love with him. Through his.
Did I say I loved him?
No. I say you love him.
I love his writing.
Yeah.
Search, I love his writing.
Anyway, you'd serve his cause.
I serve his cause, yes. Well, I try to in my modest way. You know, it's... Again, I find this... As I said earlier on, I grew up in an Ireland where Joyce was rejected and reviled.
Mm-hmm.
Where he was regarded as a disgrace to the country. And I think of my two little aunts, the two youngest surviving sisters of James, Eve and Florrie, who never married, and who were tiny, fragile, frightened little women, who were terrified that anybody would know that they were sisters of James Joyce. They lived a life I don't say misery, but sadness together in a little flat up in Mount Joy Square. And they were, as I say, terrified that people would know that they were related to Joyce. And they would, whenever I saw them, they would say, you must never, never, never let anybody know that you're related to James Joyce. It will only do you harm. And, you know, there were reasons why, like, for instance, and I find it beautifully ironic, that we're here at number 35 North Great George Street. Three doors further up at number 38, there's a plaque on the wall which commemorates the fact that a man called Sir John Pentland Mahaffey lived there. He's described as a wit and a scholar. He was provost of Trinity College around the time that Joyce was here in Dublin. And he was a classical scholar, Latin and Greek. And he had a certain disdain for the native Irish. He was a minor member of the ascendancy, and he didn't like James Joyce, and he didn't like another Irish writer called George Moore. And by coincidence, both Moore and Joyce left Dublin in the same year, in 1904. They didn't leave together that, they left in the same year. Shortly after they left, Mahaffey wrote to a friend of his and he said, "Thank God the pair of them have left Dublin, but not before they squirt and stink of the respectable citizens like a pair of demented skunks. James Joyce is living proof, if proof were needed, that it was a mistake to found a separate university for the aborigines of this island, for the corner boys who spit into the living." Mm-hmm. Words like that, mm-hmm. You know, attitudes like that affected the minds of Eve and Flory, and they became paranoid really about the whole thing. They were almost afraid to go out in the street. They thought they were being pointed out as the sisters of James Joyce. So he has left this legacy.
Well, but how do you explain your disobedience?
My disobedience?
Yeah, your independence.
Huh? Well, I suppose to a degree I was like that anyway. You know, I didn't... and I never encountered myself, I never encountered any antagonism about the fact that I was related to Joyce.
When did you start working on...
Here?
Yeah.
But I retired from my day job in 1987.
What was your day job?
Well, I worked in a bank for my sins. David Norris across the way.
Yeah.
You know who David Norris
no.
is?
No.
Well, David Norris was he was a senior lecturer in Trinity College. He lectured on Joyce. He's now a senator. He's chairman of this centre.
Mm-hmm.
And he saved this house, and he does a lot of work in conservation.
I know. Yeah, I know.
But he got in touch with me and asked me would I come along and join.
At that time,
the house was still a derelict, a ruin. It was a ruin.
This house was chosen because of the dancer, isn't it?
Well, not particularly. That turned up afterwards. It was a happy coincidence. The house was about to be pulled out as being a dangerous building.
Mm-hmm.
And David Norris wanted to save it. And he said that if they gave it to him, he would get together a group of people to restore the house and that he would use it as a James Joyce Centre. Then we afterwards discovered...
How would you explain the fact that Joyce and his has been so convincing that his whole life, he has always found people to support his work, to give him money?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Because he didn't go out of his way to be pleasant to them or anything like that. You know, you had the prime example of Harriet Weaver, the English woman, who in the course of something like 21 years gave him a couple of £100,000 in money. You had people like Sylvia Beach, who went to enormous trouble to have Ulysses published. You had all the others too along the way, like Marie Jolas. There's a litany of women who helped Joyce, including Nora Barnacle and people like that. And he never treated any of them particularly well.
He was telling people that it was a duty to do that.
Pretty well, yes. He accepted it as his right, that he should be helped.
Because
He had a mission.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why Lacan, you know Lacan, the psychoanalyst that I studied with him long ago.
Congratulations.
That did a seminar on Joyce that was called Le Saint Homme, you know?
It was published, wasn't it?
Not parts of it.
Yeah, I read an article by him, or I attempted to read an article.
And
there's
the word symptôme in France, and so he said Joyce was the symptôme.
You know him?
Yeah, very well. I like him very much.
Yeah, lovely man. Yeah, we sat over there on the Sunday morning for about 2 hours.
He has a mission to Derrida.
Has he?
He's somebody that thinks he has a mission.
I see, yes.
What's the relation of the son of James Joyce with his work nowadays?
Grandson.
The grandson.
He has no, the son is dead. Grandson, Stephen. I better not say too much on that subject.
You don't have to if you don't want to.
He has the sole rights. He is the Joyce estate.
Mm-hmm.
He has control of what is published and what's published.
Yeah.
He owns the copyright. And he guards it jealously. Mm-hmm. That's nearly the kind of way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like Lacan's inheritor, Jacques Alain Miller, the person that is married to his daughter, and he has a very jealous relationship. That's why the book on Le Symptôme has not been published yet.
I see.
Because he's the only one to establish the text. So he does it very, takes the loss of time.
Are you familiar with the James Joyce Quarterly?
No.
It's published by the James Joyce Foundation in America. And very, very good. And very, we have copies of it upstairs, going back for years now. But they had a whole edition, a whole devotion to Lacan.
Mm-hmm.
And his relationship to Joyce, or to Joyce.
Mm-hmm. It's very impressive because the language, I think that the English language is the only one where it's very clear that writers do the language because of Shakespeare and Joyce. It's more clear in the Anglophone universe than in any other.
That's why I'm very interested in this.
There's a true cult of your writers. You don't like the word.
I don't object at all. I just would hesitate to put the two of them in the same. Shakespeare is such a giant. I suppose to a degree. Joyce is too. And again, it's from the language.
But Shakespeare is the theatre. The theatre is always more lively.
Yes, I suppose so. It's their thought processes. You know, you get Shakespeare, you listen to some of the speeches, Hamlet or Macbeth, and you say, oh gosh, yeah, that's today they're as valid as they were when Shakespeare wrote it. You read Joyce, I know he's a lot closer to us, and you say, oh, that's the fellow I met down at the pub the other day, you know.
Yeah, but yesterday I read the phrase, it was, what is love, hate, I'm going to be an old man.
Yes.
You remember that phrase?
Yes.
I'm saying it
badly. Yeah. I know.
It's so strong.
Yeah.
Qu'est-ce que l'amour, la haine, bientôt je serai un vieux. It's so impressive, you know, for anybody.
You have to have, that he had, a certain arrogance.
Mm.
You know, I think towards the end of Portraits of the Artist as a Young Man, you know, this newly qualified graduate from UCD who's 20 years of age, and he, you know, his mission is so obvious to him at that time. Now,
it's impressive.
But, you know, he
how old was he when he was writing Portrait of an Artist?
Well, he was in his early 20s. He had finished
Dubliners.
He had finished Dubliners when he was 25. Today, when you think of the day, the short story, the day, he finished that when he was 25.
He's the proof that genius exists.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, and he had already started a portrait.
He had started. Oh yes, he had.
Before he finished.
He had done the first draft of Portrait. Yeah. He had done Stephen Hero. It was the first draft of.
Does the government support this center, or?
I better not say that they don't, but they don't really. No, we're trying to get around to the stage where they do. They do have certain aspects of it. We have what we call our education program. I'm sure Regina has given a copy of them, and they support that, but we don't know for how much longer they're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They support it. Not to any great extent, but they support it. Otherwise, we're running around with a begging bowl.
With a begging bowl, like Joyce.
Exactly like Joyce. I suppose it's right and proper.
Since when is Bloomsday celebrated here in Dublin?
Well, the first time it was celebrated in Dublin was in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
When five men, well known, Flann O'Brien, Miles Gaffelin, you heard of him? Flann O'Brien? Oh yeah, famous Irish writer.
Yeah, O'Brien, yeah.
O'Brien, yeah. A poet called Paddy Kavanagh, John Ryan, Anthony Cronin, another writer. And they determined to celebrate Bloomsday, and they set off from the tower in San Diego on a horse and car. But unfortunately, a bit like Ulysses or Telemachus in the Odyssey, there were too many temptations on the way. There were public houses, bars, and they didn't get too far before the thing broke up in disorder. But that was only a one-off. There were some private celebrations of Bloomsday. 1982, the centenary would have been the first big one.
Mm-hmm.
There was a gap then of another few years. It's only recently, in the last 10 years, that it has been celebrated.
Do you think it is also celebrated because of the fact that Joyce and Nora met? Would it be celebrated as Love's Day or something like that? Has something to do with love too, because Joyce, the day.
Oh yes, yes, the day. Like, I mean, it's a wonderful holiday. That wouldn't have come to my mind now as being anything that we're celebrating. The whole idea, you know, that which is a wonderful idea, really, that this sort of anniversary gift that he gave to Nora, you know, this one day, the day they first walked out together, is going to be remembered forever, you know, within the covers of his book.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, there are not too many women that have received a similar trigger, I suppose.
How many people participate of this celebration? Many Dubliners, or
There are more as time goes on. But I'm not sure that they're all doing it out of love of Joyce.
Just for the love of celebration.
Just for the love of celebration.
And drink.
You know, yeah.
Is it celebrated in other English-speaking countries?
Oh, it's celebrated all around the world.
Yeah, in
the it is quite extraordinary. We reckon last year that we know of, there were 200 celebrations of Lupus Day around the world, everywhere.
There are four in Brazil, I know.
Oh, well, then we could go.
Can you imagine?
São Paulo has a big celebration, I know.
You see how you say that Shakespeare is. See how universal
Shakespeare
is.
Yeah, oh, he is.
Shakespeare is not celebrated.
Well, it's an extraordinary thing, you see. It's the one book.
I love that.
That can't be celebrated in that way, isn't it?
Ulysses, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I just have one last question. We always speak about James Joyce's father. Who is the father of James Joyce's father? Do you know anything about
him? The father of James Joyce's father, yes.
Yeah.
Well, the Joyce family had lived in Cork, in the south of Ireland, city of the south of Ireland, for well over 100 years. Mm-hmm. They had been reasonably successful business family. By the time Joyce's grandfather, Jane, another James Joyce, was born, the fortunes of the family had gone into a bit of a decline. And James, again, Joyce's grandfather, was apparently a very handsome young man and a very acceptable partner. He made a good marriage.
Mm-hmm.
This is James Joyce. And he went to the opera. He was quite a cultured man. But he died when he was 39.
Mm-hmm.
He died at a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
And
then they became poor too?
No, not immediately. It was Joyce's father who the two little sisters that I mentioned earlier, Eva and Flory, they used to always say about their father, about Joyce's father, that he drank his way through two fortunes. You know,
drank his way to two fortunes, his father's fortune and his own.
His grandfather on the others, when he was 21, his maternal grandfather, his mother's father, gave him a present of £1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, today, £1,000 is nothing. In 1870, when he was 21, it was an enormous sum of money, but it didn't last at all. I always say that the only Joycean characteristics that I think I have inherited is a complete inability to handle either drink or money.
Complete inability to
handle either drink or money. Joyce's father had certainly got that, those characteristics, and he had a.
And yet, you are the director of the center because of this, perhaps.
No, I don't drink anymore.
But,
I don't have any money, so
but it's his father was what you call in France gaspilleur en dilapé, and he threw everything away.
Yes.
And Joyce
yes.
accumulated.
Yes.
Not money.
Memory.
Stories.
Yeah.
Words.
Yeah, he provided Joyce with these memories.
Okay.
Joyce, I don't know if you remember in Portrait of the Artist, Stephen Dedalus describes his father, and it was Joyce describing his own father, as a medical student, an oarsman, a tenor, an amateur actor, a shouting politician, a small landlord, a small investor, a good companion, a storyteller, a drinker, somebody's secretary, something in the distillery, a tax gatherer, a bankrupt, and a present appraiser of his own past.
A present?
Appraiser of his own past.
Thank you very much. Really, very glad you gave me this interview. I want you to write me the name of the scholar that lives near here. Otherwise, I...
David Harris.
Do you have something?
If you're actually...